This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The United States' top infectious disease expert says unless the vast majority of Americans is willing to receive a coronavirus inoculation, the pandemic will continue wreaking havoc on the country. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Dr. Anthony Fauci at a forum at the National Cathedral says he's hopeful the general public will be able to receive a COVID vaccine by the spring, but people have to be willing to get it.
80% of the population get vaccinated. You have an umbrella of protection already that the virus has no place to go. It would be looking for vulnerable people and not finding it.
And Dr. Fauci cautions families to really think hard about the risk of getting together for the Thanksgiving holiday.
Maybe right now's not the time to have 25 people in a house when you take your mask off as you're eating.
Jackie Quinn, Washington.
As coronavirus cases rise, hopes are fading for a recovery for the airline industry. AP correspondent Ed Donahue.
The nation's fourth biggest airline, Southwest, says there was a moderate increase in travel from August through last month, but they see a slowdown in what was hoped to be improving trends this month for Thanksgiving and next month for Christmas. JetBlue is hoping for a turnaround. It will stop blocking seats after the new year. Flights are 70% capacity now. Nicholas Callio with the trade group Airlines for America says because of the recent spike in coronavirus cases, demand is softening and it's probably not hard to figure out why. He also said airlines are still losing about $180 million a day. I'm Ed Donahue.
A Justice Department report has found that former Labor Secretary Alex Acosta exercised poor judgment in handling an investigation into wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein when he was a top federal prosecutor in Florida. But it also says he did not engage in professional misconduct. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. A Pennsylvania judge has sided with the Trump campaign on a limited number of mail-in or absentee ballots. We get more from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
The Trump campaign has secured a favorable ruling in Pennsylvania. Commonwealth Court Judge Mary Hannah Levitt has ordered Pennsylvania counties not to count mail-in or absentee ballots for which the voter didn't submit valid identification within 6 days of the November 3rd election. Trump campaign general counsel Matt Morgan calls the order a win, but the court order affects a subset of about 10,000 ballots that arrived within 3 days of polls closing, as allowed by the state Supreme Court. As of Thursday night, Democrat Joe Biden led Trump by approximately 55,000 votes in Pennsylvania. I'm Mike Gracia.
An election security committee made up of state elections officials and federal cybersecurity officials says that last week's election was the most secure in the nation's history. AP correspondent Tim McGuire explains.
Members of an executive committee of top state and federal election officials say in a statement they found no evidence of lost, compromised, or altered votes in last week's election. The committee members also reject claims made by President Trump and his supporters of widespread fraud. The committee is made up of top-level officials within the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, which was set up by President Trump 2 years ago, various secretaries of state, and election officials. They add states with close races now have paper records of each vote, allowing the recount of each ballot. Tim McGuire, Washington.
Islamic State claimed responsibility Thursday for an attack on a non-Muslim cemetery in the Saudi Red Sea, a city of Jeddah, which wounded several people, although it did not provide any evidence to back up its claim. In a statement issued through its official channel on Telegram, the group said that its soldiers had managed to hide a homemade bomb in the cemetery on Wednesday, which then exploded after several consuls of crusading countries gathered there. The explosion, which occurred during a World War I remembrance ceremony involving foreign embassies, was the second security incident to take place in Jeddah in the last couple of weeks, and it is the first attack with explosives in years to attempt to hit foreigners in the conservative kingdom. South Korea's transport ministry and Seoul City conducted a test run of a drone taxi, which is capable of carrying two people, with a demonstration in Seoul on Wednesday ahead of the country's urban air mobility service launching in 2025. A vertical takeoff and landing of the drone from China's Yihang company carrying 80 kilograms of rice bags instead of a passenger flew over downtown Seoul at an altitude of 50 meters for about 7 minutes, according to the metropolitan government. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Thousands are fleeing Ethiopia as fighting intensifies between the Federal Army and Tigrayan forces.
Ethiopia is the anchor state of the Horn of Africa, and as one diplomat pithily put it, if there was a major internal crisis within Ethiopia, it would not implode inwards, it would explode outward.
Kenya's president delivers his State of the Nation address. Cameroon separatists explain why they kidnapped a Catholic cardinal. And remembering former Ghanaian president Jerry Rawlings, who died yesterday, Thursday, at age 73.
The biggest legacy I will grant him is his readiness to accept democracy in the post-Cold War era, where several monolithic governments didn't want to hand over.
We also look at the impact of the late president's life on Ghanaian politics. A Senegal activist declared today, Friday, a day of mourning for dead migrants. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The UN Refugee Agency said Thursday that 11,000 people have fled Ethiopia into neighboring Sudan as fighting between the Ethiopian army and forces of the country's northern Tigray region intensifies. Ethiopia has long been the bedrock of stability in the Horn of Africa. Now, analysts fear a destabilized Ethiopia could have repercussions beyond its borders. VOA Salim Solomon looks at how instability in Ethiopia threatens to engulf the region.
The conflict between the Ethiopian government and fighters loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front is entering its second week. Some 8,000 Ethiopians have crossed into Sudan for safety, and aid agencies expect more in the coming days. The conflict started when Tigray fighters attacked a federal government position last week in what the government called an attempt to loot weapons and equipment. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered military action to end the armed uprising. Comfort Ero is the International Crisis Group Africa Program Director.
Right now, what we see is more and more fighting, more and more entrenched positions by both sides. Even if the Tigray forces are squeezed and overpowered, you may see a strong resistance, like a guerrilla-type resistance, and that's possible. I don't see the Tigrayans being governed anytime soon from Addis. So we could be very well looking at a long protracted situation.
Tensions have been building since September when Tigray region, one of Ethiopia's 9 regional states, defiantly held a local election after Abiy postponed the polls due to the COVID-19 pandemic. There has been less information coming from the conflict area and difficulty assessing humanitarian needs since the government shut down the internet Wednesday. Thomas Murphy is a sub-Saharan Africa intelligence analyst for the Risk Advisory Group. He says government failure to defeat the Tigray fighters may cause more trouble for the country.
The likelihood of a coup would almost certainly increase if the military fails to defeat the TPLF. And, you know, that would probably come from factions linked to the TPLF who have previously been highly influential in the government. In terms of, I guess, wider implications, Ethiopia is in a very fragile state at the moment. And I think the likelihood or the potential for tensions to escalate or to deteriorate into, I guess, pockets of conflict involving other ethnic actors across the country is probably very high.
On Sunday, the Prime Minister appointed new army chief and intelligence head to lead the war against the Tigray region. Political expert Awol Alo says solving the country's problems through guns could divide the country even further.
You know, this is a highly divided country along ethnic lines. The current constitution provides for people's right to self-determination in the sense of the ability to determine their political and cultural status, but also the right to become an independent state. So the decision of the prime minister to settle a political dispute through an armed confrontation would likely lead to the disintegration of the Ethiopian state into multiple smaller republics. And that, of course, would have a considerable ramification not just for Ethiopia, but also for the Horn of Africa.
In 2019, Abiy won the Nobel Peace Prize for his effort to end Ethiopia's hostilities with Eritrea, bringing political reform to the country and mediating disputes in Sudan, South Sudan, Kenya and Somalia. Abiy has ruled out talks with the Tigray regional leaders, but Ero of ICG says comprehensive national dialogue could save Ethiopia and the region.
The continental body in the form of the African Union, one of the most important allies for the African Union, but also for Ethiopia, the EU, are all on the same page in terms of what needs to be done to prevent this conflict from spiraling out of control and from sucking in the region where we already have, you know, a very fragile transition in Sudan, a country like Somalia, about to turn an important page in its own crisis, South Sudan's very slow transition in its own unity government. So this is not a good time for the Horn of Africa region, with one of its most important pivotal countries now going into a war footing.
The government in Addis Ababa insists the military operation will end when the north of the country is liberated and new leadership is restored in the region. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta on Thursday delivered his 2020 State of the Nation address to a joint sitting of the National Assembly and the Senate. The president's speech covered key subjects, including the COVID-19 pandemic, education, the economy, peace and security, and the ongoing constitutional review process known as the Building Bridges Initiative, or the BBI. Atiano Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
Speaking from the Parliament building, President Kenyatta announced that all students still learning from home due to the coronavirus pandemic will return to school in January 2021. President Kenyatta also instructed the Ministry of Education to announce the 2021 education calendar within 14 days.
The gradual and phased reopening of schools that began with the examination classes is being carefully monitored at all levels so as to ensure that our young Kenyans are safe and secure as they continue preparing for their national examinations. The Ministry of Education will within 14 days announce the 2021 academic calendar with all other classes expected to resume learning in January of 2021.
The President also urged Parliament to prioritize the National Aviation Management Bill to help the struggling Kenya Airways, which last made a profit in 2012.
In this regard, I urge Parliament to prioritize the consideration of various seminal bills that are pending before the legislature, such as the National Aviation Management Bill, which once enacted will anchor the turnaround of the pride of Africa, our national carrier, Kenya Airways.
Mr. Kenyatta proposed an economic stimulus package that he said would create 100,000 jobs for Kenyan youth as part of an overall effort to return Kenya's economy to its pre-coronavirus level.
My administration, with the support of Parliament, further initiated an 8-point economic stimulus program amounting to some 56.6 billion Kenya shillings. The major objective of the program was to return the economy to the growth trajectory it was on pre-corona by increasing demand for local goods and services, cushioning vulnerable Kenyans, securing household food security for the poor, and creating employment and incomes. It further seeks to create 100,000 job opportunities for the youth, besides implementing a subsidized farm input scheme for vulnerable households.
President Kenyatta also addressed the ongoing constitutional review process known as the Building Bridges Initiative, or BBI. He said that it was a deliberate step by his government to place the country on the path to greater national unity, inclusivity, peace and reconciliation. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa in Nairobi, Kenya.
A spokesperson for Cameroon separatists has admitted that the group abducted a 90-year-old Roman Catholic cardinal and the son or the chief of the Unsa community on the 5th of November. Cardinal Christian Wigan Tumi and Fon Mbinglo were kidnapped along with six members of the Fon's delegation in the troubled English-speaking Northwest region. In a press release Thursday, the Cameroon government blamed separatist rebels for perpetrating quote, terrorist acts. However, Chris Arnold, Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia, says the group did not kidnap the cardinal because kidnap or abduction implied ransom. Instead, he said they were taken for questioning.
Kidnap is the wrong word. Abduct is the wrong word. The word is arrest. Yes, the Ambazonia Restoration Forces arrested the cardinal and arrested the phone of Enso for some questioning. Now, I am not sure that you are aware that the phone of Enso, who was arrested by the Restoration Forces, has since abdicated from his palace for over 2 years to Yaounde and lived there for all this time of the conflict in Cameroon. And so when suddenly he boarded a car trying to access his palace with the cardinal escorting him, we thought it was necessary to arrest him and subject him to interrogations. I say that kidnap and abduct is the wrong word, because when you kidnap or abduct, essentially you need a ransom to be put on the table for the kidnap or abducted person to be released, or you need a quid pro quo. In this case, that wasn't so. The phone and the cardinal were merely picked up for questioning. The cardinal was immediately released after we found out, or the Restoration Forces found out, his health wasn't good. But the phone was kept in custody for 5 days and interrogated as per his activities in French Cameroon in relation to the Ambazonian struggle.
I use the word kidnapped because that's what the Cameroon government used. Let me get it right. Did you say that the cardinal and the others were arrested by your group? And if that is the case, why would you want to arrest a cardinal?
As I said, at the time that they were picked up, we really didn't know their mission. Nobody was aware. The cardinal was in that car. It's like you stop a car and before you know, the cardinal is inside or the phone is inside. So in the case of the cardinal, they let him go. They kept the phone because nobody knew the phone, who had abdicated his throne for 2 years and counting, was sneakily trying to enter the community. So that is why his own detention was a little longer than the cardinal's.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 13th. Shock and sadness swept over Ghana on Thursday following news that former President Jerry Rawlings died at age 73. Flags had to fly at half-staff as the nation enters a week of national mourning. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Seen by some as divisive and by others as a hero, former President Rawlings seized power twice in military coups but went on to bring democratic rule to the West African country. He founded a major ruling party in Ghana, the National Democratic Congress, and he became the first president of the Fourth Republic, serving two terms as a democratically elected leader from January of 1993 to January of 2001. Prosper Barney, a former chief of staff and minister in the previous 2012 to 2017 NDC administration, had a good working relationship with President Rawlings and said he would be very much missed by the Ghanaian people.
You know, he has been very instrumental in raising the voice of the voiceless, championing efforts to restructure the economy and politics of Ghana. And for that matter, we can concretely remember him for the leader that moved Ghana from a series of coup d'etats and dictatorial tendencies of previous regimes into one of democratic rule.
Patrick Kwame, a shop owner in Accra, was listening to the news on the radio and was mourning the loss. His friends and family had been calling him to talk about the former president's death. He said Rawlings' death was a huge loss for the nation.
Everybody's thinking about him. They want to remember him from his past.
Nearby, Nurse Sarah Tenge said she heard the news over social media and was sad and shocked.
And we've known him for his good morals and good rules, because during his term of regime, there was a strict respect to everyone.
Vladimir Antridanso, the Dean of Academic Affairs at the Ghana Armed Forces Command and Staff College, said Rawlings was both a unifying and divisive figure in Ghana. He was in power for 20 years in all, and his impact was significant.
The biggest legacy I will grant him is his readiness to accept democracy in the post-Cold War era, where several monolithic governments didn't want to hand over. But what he did was place himself as part of the game and came to power again in 1992 under a constitutional rule, and therefore ushered in what we now have now as our pride.
President Rawlings had been hospitalized for the past several days. There was no immediate word on the cause of death. As Ghana prepares for its presidential election on December 7th, current President Nana Akufo-Addo and opposition leader John Mahama both announced suspensions of all campaigning across the country. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
The sudden death of former Ghanaian President Jerry Rawlings is having a significant impact on political campaigns ahead of the upcoming December 7th general election. This after the two major parties suspended their campaigns following the death Thursday of the former president, which occurred at the Kurlebu Teaching Hospital in the capital Accra. The governing New Patriotic Party, NPP, and the main opposition National Democratic Congress, or NDC, have both announced the suspension of their campaigns for a week. Kwesi Jonah is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Democratic Governance. He talks to VOA's Peter Clotty about the impact that the former president's sudden death is having on the political campaign.
The fact that the two parties have suspended campaign when we have barely 3 weeks for the election is a recognition of the insignificance of the Rawlings in the political history of Ghana. We are talking about the longest reigning head of state in this country. He ruled 10 years as a military ruler and 8 years as a democratically elected civilian president. I mean, no other head of state in this country has this kind of track record. This is the man who, in 1983, when the economy of Ghana was down on its knees, was bold enough, in spite of his revolutionary enthusiasm, to go to the IMF and the World Bank to bring the Ghanaian economy back on track. And this is also the man who, in 1992, when everybody thought that he would resist the return to civil democratic politics, did in fact give in to pressure and allowed the country to return to multi-party democracy. And so he is a very, very big figure in Ghana's political history.
How do you think the campaigns will go now that the two major parties, of course, the party of the wife of the former president also has suspended its campaign ahead of the elections? But how do you expect the campaigns to go following his death?
You know, you have also 1 week of national mourning. After the end of this week, we are going to have a very crazy, intensive campaign. Yes, we are going to lose some time, but after that, at least the two major parties, the NDC and the NDP, will get into a very, very intensive campaign to finish hard.
Do you think that his death will have an impact even on the voting? Because some people are suggesting that since he is the founder of the National Democratic Congress, the biggest opposition party, the NDC could have a sympathy vote. Others are also saying the ruling party treated the former president with a lot of respect, and that his closeness with the current president could also have an impact on people swaying or voting for the ruling party. What are your thoughts?
His death will have no impact whatsoever on the voting pattern. Yes, it is true that he's the founder of the National Democratic Congress, and he's a very well-recognized and respected figure within the party. But don't forget that at the time of his death, he was in the process of finalizing his book, The Triumph of Evil, which book would have attacked many of the big, big personalities within the NDC.
Kwesi Jonah is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Democratic Governance. You are speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. Activists in Senegal have declared today, Friday, a day of mourning after at least 480 people have drowned since October 24 while trying to reach the Canary Islands by boat from the coast of Senegal. Julie Black with the Missing Migrants Project at the United Nations Immigration Agency tells Ricky Stryer that though the number of people arriving in Europe is down from past years, the number of deaths at sea is rising.
In my view, the concern is not and should not be, you know, the idea that Spain is going to be somehow overwhelmed by this, but rather that, you know, we are recording an unprecedented number of deaths on this route, and we have, you know, almost 100, possibly more, that we haven't been able to confirm because of just boats disappearing without a trace, no survivors, like no indication of what went wrong.
So are the boats disappearing at a higher rate than normal?
It's always really hard to say with irregular migration just because it's so hard to monitor this, right? These are people who are really choosing this route because they're trying to escape detection. So collecting data on this is always really challenging, and it's always hard to know if we're picking up more reports of disappearances because there genuinely are more, or if it's because there's more attention around this issue and so it's getting reported on in the news more often. I can tell you what we've started doing this year, because we do acknowledge this is an issue, and it has been. We've reported deaths on this route every year since the project began in 2014. But what we've started doing this year with IOM's displacement tracking matrix is actually we've set up basically a monitoring system to depart, to track boat departures from the Senegalese coast.
That was Julie Black, head of Missing Migrants Project. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Berlin, Germany. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with a look at Thursday's 2022 African Cup of Nations qualifying results played across 10 venues on the continent. Reigning African champions Algeria stretched their unbeaten run to an incredible 21 matches with a 3-1 win over Zimbabwe in Algiers. Ivory Coast beat Madagascar 2-1 in Abidjan. Ghana made it 3 wins from 3 matches thanks to a brace from Black Stars captain Andre Ayew in a 2-0 victory over Sudan at the Cape Coast Sports Stadium. In Ouagadougou, the Stallions of Burkina Faso were 3-1 winners over Malawi. That victory moved the Stallions level on points with Uganda, who squeezed past South Sudan 1-0 in Entebbe earlier in the day. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Arsenal was also on target for Gabon in their 2-1 win over Gambia in Franceville that moved the Panthers 3 points clear in Group D. There were also wins for Zambia, Congo and Cameroon, who thumped Mozambique 4-1 in Douala. The only draw of the day came in Pierre, where Rwanda held Cape Verde to a 0-0 stalemate. More matches will be played later on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. President of the Confederation of African Football, Ahmed on Wednesday was authorized by doctors to leave hospital after being treated after he tested positive to COVID-19 on October 30th. After a period of isolation and observation at the A.S. Salam International Hospital in Cairo, doctors authorized him to leave after showing progress in his treatment. In women's football, defending champions South Africa will face Botswana in the decider of the 2020 COSAFA Women's Championship after both won through contrasting semifinals at the Nelson Mandela Bay Stadium on Thursday. South Africa defeated Malawi 6-2. Botswana edged fancied Zambia 2-1 for a first-ever visit to the COSAFA Women's Championship and on to the cups of what will be one of their greatest triumphs in the team's history. And now to basketball news. Uganda has stepped up preparations ahead of the FIBA AfroBasket 2021 qualifiers slated for November 27th to the 29th in Alexandria, Egypt. Uganda is placed in Group E alongside host Egypt, Morocco and Cape Verde. Arnold Katabi is a PRO of the Federation of Uganda Basketball Association.
And the team has been taking shape very, very well. And the coaches and the technical team managed to trim the team that has been training at home, zeroed down to 7 players who will be joined by the 5 players when they get to travel to Egypt.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, November 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.